Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Economics 101 when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion in our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Our federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget, and closer to home, our state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems. Those data systems contained 10,799 categories of information about New York residents, and every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, all of this information about you and me is gained from 63 sources, and this information is being gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, bank, insurance company, and industry is obtaining all this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? Well, knowing how all of this information is being gathered and what information is being stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package, and let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and just as private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there in the privacy of your own home. Hey, we've been talking about the fundamentals of economics, written by Henry Hazlitt. It's about a 1 in 20 read. Economics in One Lesson is what it's called. It's the 50th anniversary issue by Henry Hazlitt, spelled H-A-Z-L-I-T-T. Probably a $15 book, paperback, 200 pages. About 25, 30 chapters in here. Wanted to hit the chapter on unions. People are always excited about unions, especially union people. Now, I used to be a union man. In fact, I belonged to three unions, three of the best. Teamsters Union, the biggest bunch of crooks in the world. Then I belonged to the Machinist Union. That's a good old boys network, if there ever was one. And then I belonged to the shipyard workers. That was a real feather bed union. That's where if you get caught working on the job, you can get fired. Now, the question arises, do unions really raise wages? Do unions really raise wages? The fact that you're making $17.58 an hour today, as opposed to $1.75 an hour back in 1975, is that the result of union activity? Well, the belief that labor unions can substantially raise real wages over the long run and for the whole working population is one of the greatest delusions of the modern age. This delusion is mainly the result of failure to recognize that wages are basically determined by labor's productivity. And it is for this reason, for example, that wages in the United States are incomparably higher than wages in England and Germany, and all during the decades when the labor movement in the latter two countries was far more advanced than here in the United States. But in spite of the overwhelming evidence that labor productivity is the fundamental determinant of wages, the conclusion is usually forgotten or derided by labor union leaders and by that large group of economic writers and politicians who seek a reputation as liberals by parroting them. Now, this conclusion does not rest upon the assumption, as they suppose, that employers are uniformly kind and generous men, eager to do that which is right. It rests, rather, on the very different assumption that the individual employer is eager to increase his own profits to the maximum. Now, if people are willing to work for less than they are really worth to him, why should he not then take the fullest advantage of this? Why should he not prefer, for example, to make $1 a week out of a workman rather than to see some other employee make $2 a week out of him? And as long as this situation exists, there will be a tendency for employers to bid workers up to their full economic value. Now, all of this does not mean that unions can serve no useful or legitimate function. The central function that they can serve is to improve local working conditions and to assure that all of their members get the true market value for their services. For the competition of workers for jobs and of employers for workers does not work perfectly. Neither individual workers nor individual employees are likely to be fully informed concerning the conditions of the labor market. An individual worker may not know the true market value of his services to an employer, and he may be in a weak bargaining position. Mistakes of judgment are far more costly to him than to an employer. If an employer mistakenly refuses to hire a man from whose services he might have profited, he merely loses the net profit that he might have made from employing that one man. And he may employ 100 or 1,000 men. But if a worker mistakenly refuses to take a job in the belief that he can easily get another that will pay him more, then the error may cost him dearly. His whole means of livelihood is involved. And not only may he fail to find promptly another job offering more money, he may fail for a time to find another job offering remotely as much money. And time may be the essence of his problem because he and his family must eat. So he may be tempted to take a wage that he believes to be below his real worth rather than face these risks. So when an employer's workers deal with him as a body, however, and a set of known standard wages for a given class of work, they may help to equalize bargaining power and the risks involved in making these mistakes. So it is true that the labor union has an edge over an individual in their negotiations because they've got more professional bargaining power. I'm not knocking the union here, and I'm not boosting the union, so I don't care which side of the fence that you're on. I'm familiar with unions. My granddad was the president of the Millworkers Union in Corbell, California, between 1941 and 1945. So I was raised in a union household, so I'm very familiar with the union and the union's benefits and their drawback. But our question here is, do unions really raise wages? Now, Haslett points out that the union could ask for and demand $50 a second. but that doesn't mean that they're going to get it. Let me give you an illustration. Let's suppose up in Detroit, we were talking about Detroit last time. Let's suppose that the bus drivers who are driving the buses, making $100 a day, said to the city, we want you to pay us $200 a day. And if you don't pay us, we're going to go out on strike. Well, since they're already losing money on the routes, and if they're losing, you know, $10 a day, and now the bus drivers say they want a $100 raise, all that means is that instead of losing $10 a day, we're going to lose $110 a day. I don't believe for a minute, no matter what the size and power or the scope of the union is that they're going to get $200 a day. It is true that if they struck and said, well, we want a $10 a day raise, $110, now the city, instead of losing $10 a day, might end up losing $20 a day, and they might buy into a $20 a day loss as opposed to a $110 a day loss. You know, we don't know. But let me show you what happens when you talk about unions and feather bedding. I was one time working for a company. It was a shipyard. I think it was called Pacific Coast Engineering in Alameda, California, as I recall. And the company furnished all of the hand tools. Now, the problem with that is that the employees stole the hand tools as fast as the company put them out. So I was working as a fitter, and I didn't have a plumb bob, and I didn't have a square, and I didn't have this and that and another thing. And so I just brought my toolbox into the job. And so I'm on my job, and I'm working away, and pretty soon the lead man comes over, the shop steward, and he said, where did you get that toolbox? And I said, it's mine. I brought it from home. And he said, but we have a contract with the company, and they have to furnish all of our hand tools. And I said, well, that's true, but there aren't any hand tools available for me to do my job, so I brought my own tools in. And he says, oh, no, you got this all wrong, son. You don't understand how this works. The company has to bring these tools onto the job. And I said, but the employees are stealing the tools and there aren't any tools to work with. And he said, that's the company's problem, not ours. Furthermore, he told me to get that toolbox off the job or I would be going off the job next. So productivity is not the objective of the union. We're not trying to increase productivity here. In fact, the union and union members subscribe to the theory that destruction brings prosperity. Make work brings prosperity, and debt brings prosperity. Remember? That there's a finite amount of work. And, you know, we got to go slow here and make this work stretch out. So, let me give you another illustration. When I was a kid, we used to haul hay out of the fields, and Frank Roach at one time had a 20-acre field and had about 4,000 bales in it, and it was a hell of a project hauling that hay out. There was about 10 men hired. Wages were $2 an hour, and we worked about 5 or 6 hours a day. So, you know, 5 hours a day at $2 an hour, that's 10 bucks, and 10 guys for 4 days is about $400. Now, when we got down to the field, we had 3 or 4 tractors and 3 or 4 wagons and 10 guys, and there's a guy on each side with hay hooks, and they're picking up the bales in the field and putting them on the wagon, and a guy on the wagon is stacking them. And everybody's working, and it's hot, and everybody's sweating, and everybody's doing their thing, and I was out there doing my job. I had my hay hooks, and I was out there picking up bales and putting them on the wagon, and now, the wagon's 8 feet wide and 16 feet long, and it holds about 20 bales to a layer, and you can load the thing from the ground about 4 layers high, about 80 bales to a wagon. Depending upon the skill of the man that's loading, will determine whether or not some, if not a bunch, of the bales will fall off the wagon on the way up to the barn. Now, at the time that we were doing this job, I looked over at another tractor and wagon, a tractor being driven by a little kid, about 6 years old, just steering it down the bale rows. And I watched a guy on the wagon and the boss. That was Frank Rocha, the boss, the owner. and he was loading the wagon over there by himself. He wasn't over here where the rest of the crew was working. He's over here by himself, and he was loading the bales with a pitchfork. And I noticed that Mr. Rocha and one man and a kid, instead of three men loading and another man driving, that's four men on a wagon now. I noticed that he, working by himself on the ground, could load that wagon. And he didn't load it four bales high, he loaded it seven bales high, because with a pitchfork he could reach up higher. 20 times 7 is 140 bales. Furthermore, I noticed that the way he loaded the wagon, that is, the loader that he was working with, when he loaded the wagon, he loaded it in such a way that he tied the bales together so that they didn't fall off. They didn't rock around as the wagon was going over rough spots in the field or up the lane. And that when Mr. Roach's wagon got up to the barn, he got there with 140 bales. But when my wagon got up to the barn, it got up there with 80 bales or 60 bales or something like that. So at lunchtime, when May came down, put on a big spread, everybody's eating. Mr. Rocha was sitting there eating, I went over to him and I said, "Now, Mr. Rocha, I noticed that when you were loading hay, you were loading with a pitchfork." And he said, and I said to him, "Can you tell me why you're loading those with a pitchfork? And everybody over here is laughing at you. They're making fun and mocking you." Now, this was my first job, and I'd never loaded hay before. I didn't know one way or the other. And so this old man said to me, he said, "Well, the reason that I'm loading hay with a pitchfork is because I'm too lazy to work." And I thought, now that's amazing. Here we have three men loading a wagon, and he just has two men. So with one-third less labor, he can load the wagon twice as fast and do a better job of it. That's called productivity. Now, the reason he's interested in productivity is because he's the one that's paying the $2 an hour to all the rest of us guys. He's the one that's paying the wages over here, and this is money coming out of his pocket. Now, this is going to take us about 4 days to move these 4,000 bales. So it's going to cost him about $400 to move 4,000 bales. So it's about 10 cents per bale. But I noticed that he was loading twice as many bales with nearly half as many people. In other words, his productivity was producing a bale of hay to the barn for 5 cents, and the rest of us were producing a bale of hay to the barn for 10 cents. And I mused about that. Now, when that year was over and the next year came around, I suggested to Mr. Rocha that maybe he would pay me 5 cents a bale to put the hay in the barn. And he smiled at me kind of knowingly and said, "Well, if I were to do that, it would disrupt the rest of the crew and they wouldn't work for me." He said, "I hear what you're saying. But I need to move that hay so if it's going to rain, I can get it all done. I got to get it done in a short period of time. I don't have a week or two or three for you to put that hay in the barn because it might rain on it." Some years later, I was working for a guy by the name of Tony Nunes. And Tony had about 4,000 bales. That's about what you get off of 20 acres. And I said to him, "I'll make you a deal. I will put all of that hay in the barn for 5 cents a bale." And he thought about that for a minute, and he mused about it, and it kind of went around and around. And so he said, "Oh, I don't know. Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think it's because he couldn't count, and I don't think he'd ever computed what the cost per bale was." So I told him this story about Frank Rocha. I said, "Now, you're going to hire a crew, and about 10 guys are going to come out here, and we're going to stir up a lot of dust, and it's going to cost you about $400. And so he got to thinking about that, and he said, "Yep, that's about what it's going to be." I said, "Here's what I'll do. I'll put all that hay in the barn for you for a nickel a bale. I want you to pay me $200. I'll put it in there at half price." And that appealed to him, and he said, "Okay, you go ahead and do that. I'll contract that out to you then you put it in the barn, but you got to have it in the barn by the 15th. That's the 15th of June. So, okay, we'll do it. Called my friend Leo, and I said, hey, Leo, why don't you come down here and we'll make a couple of bucks. So we came down, and I organized it like this. I had two tractors and four wagons, and so I hooked the two wagons behind each tractor. I went down in the field. Leo took one tractor, I took the other one, about a half a mile down here to the field. It's about a one-mile round trip. We loaded the wagons with a pitchfork. I'm on the ground, Leo's loading, and we would load up the four wagons, and we could do that in 2 hours or less. We would drive it up to the barn, and then we would bring the two wagons into the barn, use an elevator, and stack the hay in the barn. We could do four loads in the morning, four loads in the afternoon. This is between milkings. I mean, you know, we got to be up at 4 o'clock in the morning to milk the cows, get the barn work done. And then 9 o'clock until about noon, we'd haul four loads up. And then we'd take off for a half an hour for lunch, grab a bite, and then we'd run down. And we'd do another four loads and come back. We'd finish about 3 o'clock, maybe 3:30. That's eight loads a day. Now, when we got through in about 4 days, we'd put 4,000 bales in the barn. Now, we had to work. We had to hustle. We had to move. Unlike people who were out there with hay hooks, now, these people are all working. Now, here's my point. You can have a guy out here working, and he can have sweat dripping off the end of his nose. And he's moving 80 bales an hour. You can have another guy over here, and he's working, and he hasn't got any sweat dripping off his nose, and he's moving 160 bales an hour. Now, how do you explain that? You can go out in a field and watch Mexicans cutting lettuce, and you'll see lettuce cutters out there, and one guy is producing twice as many boxes of lettuce as another. Why is that? And that's because measuring people's productivity by the hour is counterproductive. If a guy is working by the hour, he doesn't care whether or not he packs 3 boxes of lettuce an hour or 30 boxes an hour. When a guy's working for $2 an hour, he doesn't care if he's loading 30 bales an hour or 300 bales an hour. But when he's working for a nickel a bale, he's very concerned about how many bales an hour he can get moved. And that's the essence of productivity over employment. And that's my point. Now, when we finished the job, we got paid $200. That was $50 a day for each of us for the 4 days. Now, here's what this boils down to. See, I'm getting paid $300 a month in board and room. So I'm only making $10 a day to start with. So in 4 days, I was only going to make $40. But I was making $25 a day. We made $200 in 4 days, is $50 a day, $25 each. I made 2.5 times as much money doing those nickel a bale as I did by working for $10 a day. Now, this is back in the 1950s when $10 a day in board and room was pretty good wages. And Nunes just cried his eyeballs out. When he did the arithmetic, he said, my God, you were getting paid $25 for 6 hours work. You were getting paid more than $4 an hour. And he said, I could have hired men over here for $2 an hour. Can you follow that? Now, this man, you know, he didn't go to college, but he had a high school diploma. He was a businessman. He was running a 100-cow dairy. And that's the kind of economics that we learn here in America. We learn how to count, but we don't learn how to do business. You know, the guy could count, and he said $2 an hour versus $4 an hour. Let me ask you this. What difference did it make to Mr. Nunes if I was to make $4 an hour hauling hay, and he could have hired all these day laborers out here for $2 an hour, but when you pay the $2 an hour, it costs you $400 to put your hay in the barn, but when you pay me $4 an hour, it only costs you $200 to put your hay in the barn. You actually saved $200. I pointed that out to him. And at the time, I was just a a little out of high school, probably 20 years old. It grated on him. He could see that he saved $200, but I made $4 an hour. And $4 an hour was beyond his comprehension. $2 an hour was the standard wage. Now, if everybody would work for $2 an hour and put in a day's work, that would be good. But boys and girls, when people are working for $2 an hour, they will tell you that they're putting in a day's work, and they may really believe it. But there's a big difference between the productivity of a man that's working for $2 an hour and a man that's working for 5 cents a bale. If you pay that same man $4 an hour, is he going to produce twice as much? Do you believe, all of you employers out there, all of you laborers out there, listen up now. Whatever your employer is paying you, I don't care what it is, $10 an hour, $20 an hour, do you believe that if your employer would double your pay, you would double the amount of work that you turn out in a day? Do you believe that? But let me show you how you can double your productivity in a day. And I don't care who you are or what job you're in or what you're doing. No matter what you do, you could do twice as much if you put your mind to it. You could do the work that you do in 8 hours in 4 hours if you really wanted to. Now, I was running the Atlantis Company in Boise, Idaho many years ago, now 30 years ago, back in 1980. And I had an operation there, took up 5,000 square feet of space and several machines, and I had three men working, making deck and risers. These deck and risers wholesaled for $25 and retailed for $50, like a fair trade item in a grocery store. They're just locked into that price. I'm not going to get any more for them. You're not going to make an improvement on it and get any more money for it. So we had to manufacture those for $12.50 a piece, net, FOB the warehouse. Now, it was costing me about $18. I did a little math on it, and I looked at the cost, and doing $18, I'm making $6 a piece on these deck and risers. A man came into my plant one day, and he said, I will make these deck and risers for you and deliver them to you at your factory for $25 a piece, which is what they wholesale for. So a question arises in my mind, do I want to devote 5,000 square feet of factory space to making deck and risers, or would I be money ahead to take that same 5,000 square feet of space and make frames or headboards or something else, and just buy these deck and risers for $25 and sell them for $25, just trade dollars, but utilize the 5,000 square feet, which might make me 2, 3, 4, 5 times as much money. So my conclusion was, I'm going to make frames on this space, and I'm not going to make deck and risers. So I announced it to the three men, and I said, this is a marginal operation here. In fact, I was watching the news last night, and I saw that Toyota is going to close down a big automobile manufacturing plant in San Jose, California. And they've got about 4,000 employees there, and they're going to lay them all off. See, these 4,000 employees that are about to be laid off at this factory, they could double their productivity if they wanted to. And if those employees would double their productivity, Toyota would not close that factory. And they're down there marching, and they've got placards, and they're just dancing around in the streets and having fights in the union hall about Toyota closing the factory. And this is a unionized operation, and these guys are making an average of $28 an hour plus their fringe benefits. But Toyota can move that factory's production to Mississippi and save money, and that's what they're going to do. And that's why these companies can move their factories to Taiwan or South Korea or someplace else. And by golly, that's what they're going to do. So boys and girls, if you want to protect your job, running around with placards and threatening a strike and so on, that's not going to impress your boss near as much as doubling your productivity, doubling the amount of work that you put out. Because the minute you do that, your boss is going to sit there and say, this guy's too valuable to let go. Now, if an employee is working for you for $10 a day, and it costs you $12 a day for that employee, he's making you 10, but he costs you 12. You're losing $2 a day. Are you going to keep that employee? The answer is hell no. You're going to get rid of him because he's a liability. He's a loser. Now, let's suppose you got a guy. He's working for you for $10 a day. He produces $10 a day. He doesn't cost you anything, but he doesn't make you anything. Are you going to keep him? What's the point? I don't make any money off of this guy. Now, let's suppose you're paying a guy $10 a day and he makes you $20 a day. And you're making a $10 a day profit off of this guy. And the guy says to you, I think I'll leave here because I can get more money working down the street. What are you going to do with that guy? You're probably going to give him a $2 an hour raise and say, I'll give you $12 an hour. I don't want you to leave. Stay here. You're a profitable employee. You know, in the scripture, the Messiah made an observation. He says, when you've done your day's work, when you've done what's expected of you, call yourself an unprofitable servant because you've done that which is expected. You've done that which is a requirement. That's what we're expecting from you. If you want to be noticed by the management, you want to be a profitable servant. And a profitable servant is a guy that makes his boss money. So let's take a break here, and we'll come back, and I'll show you how to do that. Meanwhile, back on the farm here, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, be sure to order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Economics 101, written by Henry Hazlitt. It's H-A-Z-L-I-T-T, Henry Hazlitt, Economics in One Lesson. It's about 25 chapters, probably 200 books, very short chapters, straight and to the point. talking about such things as unions and do they really raise wages. He talks about the broken window story, the blessings of destruction, public works mean taxes, taxes discourage production, credit diverts production, the curse of machinery, spread the work schemes, disbanding troops and bureaucrats. I mean, it's the exact opposite from everything that you've heard all of your life in high school and college. It's the free economy or free economics position dealing with economies and economics. It's the opposite to socialism and the socialist approach. Now, I'm not here to change any of you people's minds out there. I don't want you to think I want you to quit the union or give up on socialism now. What I wanted to do was to tell you, here's why your economy, here's why your nation is disintegrating right in front of your eyeball. There are certain laws, certain principles that work in life. I always liken it like this. You're driving down the highway one day, and you come up to a sign, like we used to have here at the Lolita Overpass, and it said 35 miles an hour. Now, all of us kids, you know, when you get to be 16, you get a driver's license, you know, pretty soon, it doesn't take you long to figure out that you're a better driver than anybody else, no matter the fact that they've been driving for 30 or 40 years. And when you come to a sign that says 35 and you speed up to 40 and you negotiate this S curve at 40 miles an hour, you say to your buddies in school, haha, well, that sign may say 35, but I can drive under there at 40. And then, of course, then your old buddy David Wagner, he says, oh, no. So he goes out and he does it at 45. And then your old buddy Ed O'Neill, he comes along and says, oh, shucks, I can do it at 50. And then we just keep escalating, see? Now, we just keep the increments just keep going up by 5 miles an hour at a time. But it is true, there's a limit to how fast an automobile can negotiate that turn. At age 16, we didn't know what it was, but I think it was Ronnie Quillen, if I remember right, at a 49 mark, and he was trying to do that at about 60, and he ripped off the side of his car and rolled it over and totaled it out. And that's what told us where the limit was on the Lolita Overpass. The limit was somewhere around 55 to 60, but 60, it wouldn't quite make it. Now, those old 49 Mercs, you know, were about as low to the road as you could get. My old 47 Plymouth wouldn't do that, but, you know, he might have if anybody was going to do it at 60. Now, today, I would imagine somebody goes under there with a Porsche or a 280Z, it might make it at 60 or 65 or 70. But, you know, even at that, there's a limit. I don't know where the limit is. But, you know, even a Porsche isn't going to go under there at 110. So now, with that little piece in mind, there are limits in economics. There's some things you can do and get away with, and there's some things that you can't. Well, back in the 1970s, late 60s and going into the early 70s, there was a program called the FHA 235 program. And I wanted to participate in that, so I went over to San Francisco. It was put out by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, I believe. And they were renovating houses over there under what they called the Davis-Bacon Act. Now, the Davis-Bacon Act was enacted back in the 1930s under the Roosevelt administration, and it dictated what the wages were that you had to pay. Now, I'd been renovating houses over in Oakland for about 3 years. And I was doing four houses a year, and I was making pretty good money at it. Kind of like this old house, you know, on PBS. You go in, buy the house, renovate it, bring it up to current standards, you know. You got to fix all of the deficiencies in it, put a new roof on, and replumb it, and rewire it, and things like that. And then this house is brought up to current standards, you know. And then you'd sell it, and there'd be a profit in there. Well, under the Davis-Bacon Act, you had to pay certain wages, and the wages were about 50% more than market wages. Well, we couldn't pay Davis-Bacon wages in Oakland on a private job, but these were government jobs. See, this was a government house, and you're going to go in here and you're going to bid on this house, but you got to bid on it paying these kind of wages, and so you bid about 50% more. They weren't very economical, and a lot of the houses would cost more to renovate and fix than you could sell them for. Well, that made them uneconomical, and it reminds me of that story I told you the last time. Up in Detroit, they got 139 square miles. 40% of it has already been demolished. And they had a story, it was on PBS, and these community volunteers had come over to this old house. It was all beat up, and, you know, I'm a general contractor, and so I looked at that house, and I said, well, it looks like I could renovate that house. No, they tore it down. They tore it down, and they loaded it all up. They had a bobcat out there, and they were knocking it down, and they had all these volunteers, and they were stripping the house out. And so, yeah, they destroyed the house and hauled it away. I could have remodeled that house. I couldn't remodel it and sell it in Detroit because, you know, you got to have willing buyers that want to buy it. And the reason that these houses in Detroit are being abandoned is because there's what they call white flight. People are leaving Detroit. They're moving out. Now, there was a time when people were moving into Detroit. Detroit was growing. It was vibrant. Now people are moving out, and they're destroying the city. They're tearing it down. And so people are lamenting this destruction of the city, but they don't understand what happened. What is causing this? Well, Davis Bacon is one. Labor unions is two. FEMA is three. FHA is four. Government OSHA and EPA regulations is five and six. And we could go on and on and on. These all add costs. For instance, in California, before you ever break ground, it costs you $30,000 to get the permits in order to build a house. $30,000 of the house cost in California. It just deals with the permits and all of the bureaucracy and red tape. So that has to be put onto the value of the house, the final price of the house. And pretty soon, this thing gets blown so far out of proportion, so far out of kilter, that it becomes economically unviable. I'll put another way, let's suppose that you had $100,000 in the bank, cash. It's your 401k. And I come up to you and I say, gee, you know, we could take that $100,000 and build a house. And then sell that house for $200,000. We could build the house in 90 days. And you could double your money in 90 days. Would you like to do that? That's what the free market and the free enterprise system is all about. You've got the cash. You've saved it up. Now we can take it and go down to Home Depot and buy the lumber. And then we can go out and employ our labor and put that thing together. And then what's it going to sell for? And it's going to sell for about $200,000. Now let's add on Davis Bacon wages, and let's add on $30,000 for the building permits, and so on and so forth. And then, now you take your $100,000 out, and it's not going to cost $100,000 to build it. It's going to cost $180,000 to build it. Well, you'd still make $20,000. Would you like to risk $100,000 of your life savings to make $20,000 maybe? See, that's not nearly as good an idea, is it? Now, here's where we are in Detroit. You got a house out here, and it's got some kind of an economic value. I bought one house one time out on 23rd Avenue in Oakland, up off of Bancroft, 23rd Avenue, off Bancroft. And I paid I'm right at $12,000 for it. Now, I own the house. Now, it cost me $5,000 to bring it up to standards. I'm in at $17,000. I sold it for $28,500, which was the maximum because of the square footage. That's all that we could get financed. So, $17,000 to $28,000 leaves us in there $11,500 profit. Took me 90 days to do that. And I could do four of those houses a year. That's a pretty profitable business. That's free enterprise. That's the marketplace. Now, when the government gets involved and they say, well, you got to pay these kind of wages, if I had to pay Davis Bacon wages to remodel that house, I couldn't have done it, because then it would have cost me, you know, $28,000 to do the job, and then I'd sell it and I wouldn't make any money. I could go in there and work, but I couldn't make any profit. Now, if I can do that house and make a $10,000 profit in 90 days, I'm all ear balls and I want to go do that. If I'm going to work for 90 days and I'm going to make little or no profit, then I don't want to do that. Now, that's what makes labor, and that's what makes productivity. If you want to be employed, then you've got to do something that's profitable. It's got to be productive. So instead of thinking about employment, let's think about productivity, because the minute you're productive, you're employed. It's just that simple. The minute that you are productive, you become employed. Now let's go back to Frank Roach, and let me tell you another little story over there. I was working for old Frank, and just green as a gourd, 15-year-old kid, you know, summer job in high school. So I got to clean the barn. Now, this barn's 210 feet long. 210 feet. Frank has three full-time hired men. I'm the third guy. Takes four men to milk 140 cows, 240-acre dairy. Pretty standard in the industry. Now, Frank had probably more labor working because he didn't have as many elevators, hydraulics, tractors. He was still farming with horses. Other dairies milking 100 cows were being operated with two men. Frank was operating 140 cows with four men. That's himself and three hired men. So he was actually doing more for the employment scene. He actually was hiring just about twice as many hired men. Later, I worked for a guy 2 miles away from Frank, Lindy LaFranchi. And Lindy milked about 110 to 120 cows, just him and I, just the two of us. But we had a bulk tank, and we had hydraulics on the tractors, and we had elevators, and, you know, we had machinery and mechanization. Now, getting back to Frank over here, I've got to milk the cows. So I'm over here milking cows, and my job was to turn the cows out after we finished milking on one side. Now, as the cows would walk out of the barn, they would defecate walking out, and there was about 5 wheelbarrow loads of manure on each side. That's 10 wheelbarrow loads per day. And my job was to scrape the barn and haul it out, clean out the barn. Well, one day, instead of turning the cows out from the end, I did it from the end closest to the door. I let out 10 cows and I drove them out. Not one cow defecated on the floor. I went to the next 10 cows and about 1 out of 10 did. And so on down the line, there's 7 groups of 10. Now, instead of every cow defecating as she walked out of the barn, only about 10 cows did. And so I didn't have near as much to clean up. Well, that worked out pretty well that night and worked out pretty well that next morning. So I finished breakfast, and I jumped up, and I ran out to the barn, and I went to work, and instead of 2 hours to clean the barn, which was normal, I did it in about 1 hour. Now, the other two guys, they did the other barn work, and it took both of them about 1 hour, and normally, I would catch up with the rest of the guys about an hour later. After they got started with whatever project we were working on, I'd go out there and go help them. Now, this particular morning, now that I'm ready to strike, I come into the milk house and I told Mr. Rocha, I said, well, what do you want me to do next, Mr. Rocha? And so he looked at me like I was suffering from the terminal stupids, because this was about 1 hour or less into the operation doing the barn work, and he said angrily, do the other side. So I said, I've completed the job. I'm done. Now, he knew it took 2 hours to clean the barn. So, he whipped off his apron, he walks over and he looks down the barn and it's clean as a whistle. He walks over to the other side of the barn, it's clean as a whistle. And he looks at me, I'm a skinny 15-year-old kid, weigh 130 pounds maybe. and he tore into those other two guys. Now, he was a Portuguese, and he was talking to them in Portuguese, but even though I didn't understand Portuguese, I could tell he was using a lot of bad words. He just read them the Riot Act. Why? Well, because here's a skinny city kid comes out here and can clean the barn in an hour, and these two guys take 2 hours. Well, in my first few days, it took me 2 hours to clean it also. But I worked on my productivity, and I devised a strategy whereby I could complete the job in 1 hour instead of 2 hours every day. Now, you know, that's 7 hours a week. In other words, 7 hours a week is about one man day, isn't it? Now, he doesn't pay me a dime more. You know, I'm getting paid $175 a month right at this moment in time. It was because of that increase in productivity that Mr. Rocha increased my wages from $175 to $250, which was standard hired man's wages. See, he didn't give me the $250 a month when he hired me because I was a 15-year-old skinny kid with no experience. But once I demonstrated my productivity. All right, now let me show you one more little trick. Another thing that he needed to do was to clip his fields. And there's some things that have to be done every day. For instance, it takes 4 hours to milk the cows twice a day. That's 8 hours a day milking cows. That has to be done every day, 7 days a week. And so fixing fence is something that doesn't have to be done every day. So you do fixing fence or clipping fields or doing things that you'd like to do that would increase your productivity, increase your volume of milk. And so Rocha told me, he said, well, we don't have irrigation here. We rely upon green feed. And if we were to clip our pastures as soon as the cows left the field, we would get about 50% more grass back. And the more grass we get, the more milk we get. So if I could clip all of my fields right after the cows come out of them, I'd get about 50% more grass, which means that I would probably get about 50% more milk. 50% more milk would give me 50% more profit because it doesn't cost me a dime more to produce 2 gallons out of a cow as it does to produce 1 gallon. So if I could get an extra half a gallon out of that cow, say 2.5 gallons out of a cow instead of 2 or 1.5 instead of 1, I would be increasing my bottom line profit. Now, right away, I, 15 years old, I could see that. Yeah, I wasn't lost to that. So I started, in my spare time, I would jump on this little Farmall tractor, Farmall A model tractor, 55 model as I recall, with a 5-foot belly mower, and I'd run down and I'd start clipping fields. And Mr. Rocha was very pleased that without telling me, that I would go down and do that because it needed to be done. And then I was a kid, and a kid on a tractor, that was just like heaven to me because I wanted to drive. And so I'm out there driving, just having a good time, and I'm down there clipping fields. And sometimes I would clip until, 11, 12 o'clock at night. And then because it was a new tractor and it had lights on it, sometimes I'd work all night, and then I'd bring the cows up at 4:30 in the morning and start milking at 5. By the time he came out, I had the cows in. One side's in, milking machines are on by the time he got out there. Not only was my productivity greater than the other two men, but my willingness to work was greater. So Mr. Rocha, while he would not raise my pay beyond $250, which was standard wages, and nobody would break that wage barrier, he would instruct his wife, May, when I needed a pair of boots, she'd get me a pair of boots, and then when I went to pay for it, you don't need to pay for that. When I needed a carton of cigarettes, she would bring the cigarettes, but I didn't have to pay for it. When I needed gas in my car, he'd say, just go fill it up out of the tank, and I never paid for it. He gave me these fringe benefits, which were probably worth another $75 a month, maybe $100. Bought my clothes, bought my boots, bought my cigarettes, bought my gasoline. Because when we went back to school, I stayed working there, and I worked part-time. I milked in the morning, milked at night, but I went to school. Now, here's the moral to the story. Productivity is your friend. Work is your friend. And I don't care who you're working for. Let me tell you that your employer is motivated by profit. And the guy that makes the most profit for the boss is the guy that's going to stay there, and the other guys are going to leave. So when the end of the year came, there's about a three-month lull starting in December, January, and February, those 3 months, he laid off the other two guys, and here I am, a high school kid going to high school, and Rocha and I did all of the work, fed the cows. They were dry, you know, in the wintertime, they're dry. And we're just feeding the cows and feeding the calves and the heifers and doing our thing. And my productivity was enough before and after school to replace a full-time man. Now, that's what productivity is all about. And unions coming in and making demands upon the employer is not what motivates the employer to pay more money. It's productivity that promotes more money. And without the productivity, the employer couldn't pay you any more money anyway because there isn't any money there to pay. The employer can only pay you out of what you produce. Now, let me show you something. You're working in a shop and they're charging $25 an hour. Your boss is paying you 10 bucks an hour. The customer pays 25. You get 10, the boss gets 10, and the government gets 5. That's the way that breaks down. If you're making 50 bucks an hour, that's your shop rate, and they're paying you 25, uh-oh, watch out, partner. That's not very productive. By the time your boss pays the cost of keeping you employed, it's 35, he's making 15. He's dealing with 50 and he's making 15. You're on the ragged edge there. You want to make sure that your boss is making as much or more in profit as you produce. And if you can do that, you're going to be there forever. And if your boss's business is running down and he doesn't have as many customers, what you want to do is to economize. You want to be the guy that's working in the shop or in the plant that is an economist. That is, you want to be alert to what is saving the company money and what is making the company money. And then zero in on those endeavors. While the rest of the guys are dragging around and they're trying to cost the company money by feather bedding. They're not producing to the maximum. They're not interested in production. They're just interested in collecting a paycheck. Well, okay, in boom times, that's great, and feather bedders have a place in boom times, but when you're in desperate times, when you're scrambling to keep this thing operating, when you're scrambling to make your company exist, then it's productivity that counts. Quick story, buddy of mine up in Boise, Idaho, had a boy working for a plumbing company. At one time, they had, it was a bunch of plumbers, I think it was 126 men on the payroll. They're down now to just the boss and my buddy's son, just the two of them. That guy was the most valuable fella out of 126 plumbers on the job. The last guy to go will be the most productive employee in the company. That's the last guy to be let go. Hey, I'm running out of time, so let me give you a reminder here that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. Remember, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there, so we'll have to say so long for now. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.